Hello. Welcome to my session. Thanks for showing up. My name is Michael, and I'm working for a open source consultancy company, Openismos. We are located in Berlin and Munich in Germany. And this talk will summarize my experience that I had with implementing input methods on mobile devices over the last couple of years. And I will present them in the form of what challenges that you will face as an input method developer working on mobile. So who of you is working on input methods? Maybe just quickly raise your hands. Anyone? Okay, who's working on word prediction or word correction engines? No one. Again? Okay. So you're working on OpenAdaptText, so that's an actually a word engine that became open source last year or 2 years ago. And it works on Android and iOS, I think.
Yeah. And,
and on Tizen. Yeah. So yeah. Later in that session, we will come to that part why you need that, actually. So why these word engines are so important and what you can do if you don't want to pay tons of money to, for example, Nuance. But let's get started here. So what's mobile text input? In a simple way, I would say it's any kind of text input method on a mobile device. And what you could see as text input is everything that converts input into text. And for that, you would have speech recognition, handwriting recognition, you could have a Bluetooth keyboard, or you could have, what probably most of you will use on a mobile device, a virtual keyboard. There are actually some other ways that can also convert input to text, but we leave it at that. But a text input method is not just the text conversion itself. It's also what you would then do with the text once it ends up in the application. You might want to select text for copy-paste. You might want to position the cursor and fix some spelling mistakes or whatever. Or you want to probably format text when you take some notes with your tablet or your handset. So that's altogether mobile text input. And why is it important? What's actually the first challenge here that we face? It's used in marketing. And I have to apologize for the badly scaled up image. I used a bad camera. And this picture is taken at Union Square. It's just 50 minutes away from here, actually, if you walk. And you can see that on one of the buildings there. You have this iPad advertisement. And let's look at that. Of all the features they could have used to advertise their iPad, they've chosen to use the virtual keyboard. Now, why is that so? First of all, it allows to differentiate. So you have same hardware, same form factor, you have basically the same applications running on it, email client and a web browser. But with the virtual keyboard, it's very easy for you to create a different user experience. And the next part of it is, as a user, you're exposed to it nearly on a daily basis. You will often use the virtual keyboard. It's not a standalone application as such, like a browser. You will always have to use it for maybe 10 seconds or half a minute or whatever, but you use it very often and you use it daily. So that's why it's such a big part of the user experience. That's at least how Apple sees it. And actually what Apple did, they've built a brand around it. If you go back maybe 10 years or so, what they first did with the hardware keyboard they had, it came in a very special design. Very flat, very this gray and white colors there. And then everyone started to copy this design, this hardware keyboard design. And when Apple came with the iPhone and with the iPad, what did they do? They actually took the design of their hardware keyboard because that was an established brand. Users or consumers would recognize that. And they put it on their iPad, on the iPhone. And that's why they still keep using it in advertisement. So even the input methods might not be the most important feature on a mobile device. For me, it would be a battery lifetime, actually. So it's used in marketing. Now, if you look at that, that's, again, Union Square. And look what you have in the front. It's a bit dark, maybe, but there's the Nokia Windows Phone advertisement. And we see in the background the iPad advertisement again. So some companies don't agree that you should use virtual keyboards as a marketing concept. And well, you can probably figure out which of the companies is more successful these days. The next thing, so just having a different or an elegant design is not good enough these days. This is from the BlackBerry 10 announcement video. Some of you might recognize it because of this multi-word ribbon UI. So they had to make sure that it is actually cleverly designed because Research and Motion, that's a hardware keyboard company. That's what they sell. And now they switch to a virtual keyboard for their next operating system, for the next iteration of it. So that's kind of a big deal. So they came up with a virtual keyboard where they promise you will be at least as fast as the hardware keyboard, probably faster. Now, is that believable, or is it just a hoax? I think they have a point here, and that's if you analyze the video, it's just 3 or 5 seconds actually of that whole video of this 40-second advertisement that they have there. You find it on YouTube. What they do is they show the word candidates close to their starting letter. Now, what happens if you start typing it? You kind of expect where the words will appear. Without even looking, you will start to select the words just by guessing. And then it becomes very, very similar to the T9 experience, where if you go back again 10 years or so, people got really quick and really fast with using T9 blindly. And that's what RIM is targeting for, that you can use a virtual keyboard without having to look all the time, and that you will use word prediction all the time. So this is not just error correction, what they have here. That's a very sophisticated word prediction system. So it analyzes the grammar, it analyzes what you've written so far and what you're going to write, and is going to propose candidates based on that. So it's not just simple error correction, what you have here. The next aspect why input methods are important, it's discussed in every review. So other aspects are, of course, discussed as well, but you can do that, go through the third or fourth chapter or paragraph of a review of a mobile device, preferably on Engadget, and then we talk about the virtual keyboard or any kind of input method. And if you might be able to read some of the headlines, and it's what's kind of a big deal about what I said before, because they're switching away from the hardware keyboard, and everyone was writing about it. So here's the point. If you cleverly design or innovate, reviewers will write about it. So that's free marketing for you. That's why you should think about your input methods. So I can also give you a short list of things that reviewers generally love and hate. What they love is elegant design. It needs to be appealing, right? That's what you have on iOS. They love smart haptic feedback, something that you don't just turn off immediately. So actually that contributes to the experience. Oh, I'm just hitting the key here. Oh, I'm actually sliding between keys. You can do that these days, but most people don't try, and developers are usually not the ones to find these details or to wanting to do that. It's a very annoying feature for them, they would say. But if you get it right, you can get good reviews for that as well. And they love clever solutions, as shown with the BlackBerry 10 announcement. What they hate is poor global copy-paste. Actually, any kind of slightly broken copy-paste implementation, they will hate it. They will write paragraphs about paragraphs how bad it is, and then people will start copying it and complaining about it, about that one feature. Just because you couldn't select text in your browser and were able to paste it into your email client or the other way around. So it's very easy to screw that part up. And if you do that tiny, tiny mistake, your reviews will become very negative suddenly, even though you got the rest right. So pay attention to that. The next thing that you can get wrong very easily is wrong defaults. Reviewers, if they get these devices, they spend 10, 15 minutes with that, and then they start writing, actually. They will not spend time to go through your complex settings application and find all the configuration that would make for optimal text input experience. They will just use how it comes out of the box. Powered on, start using it. Ah, that's crap, that's great, whatever. Start writing the review. And that's actually quite similar how your consumers will use your virtual keyboard, for example. They will not bother with these settings, at least the majority won't. There are some technical advanced users, some power users that will, but those are not the ones, you know, generating a profit for you. You need to target for the mass audience. And so what I can say is get your defaults right. Think about that. Do usability tests. It's not always how it, how you would think it should be. The consumers will tell you. And this is maybe only if you have worked in product development and have worked in input methods, and that actually applies to some other parts as well. But so we have this small circle there, input methods, which is part of a bigger team, what we would call application framework. What does application framework actually provide? All the tools, all the UI toolkits, all the libraries that you need to write applications. And to dog feed your own toolkits and frameworks and what you have written, you probably will have a set of core applications. And these developers will also be part of your platform development team. So everything that we see in the yellow circle is probably what you have under control. That's your platform development team, right? So for, that's if you take it in the context of Tizen, that would be most of the developers that are paid by Samsung and Intel, who provide actually the software for your platform. Now, input methods, they have a tough job. I can tell you that from my own experience. Because you need to actually get your defaults right, and you need to get your input methods working very fast, very quickly, and get to a decent state. Because if you don't, then your core application developers will start writing workarounds. And once you have a working solution that actually should not make that, that should replace that workaround, they will argue with you for hours and days and weeks that they, that their workaround is better. And what you end up is an inconsistent platform, and they don't like that at all. You don't like that at all, but they don't care about it, that you have an inconsistent platform, because they focus on their application, and their application, their workaround works perfectly. They don't care, that looks different in every application. So if you don't get it right in the first place, you will have a lot of fighting to do, and you need to be a good communicator to convince them. So think about that. Get it right the first time. And if you look even further to third-party application developers, you have absolutely no control over those guys. And once they start shipping their own virtual keyboard implementations, you know you screwed up. So that were the non-technical challenges that you will face. Now let's go a bit to the technical side here. I will not show any code, not in this session here. I will give a link later where you can read about some stuff, but no code here in this session. So the first advice, make it fast and accurate. Why? Because that offers a baseline for a good UX. If it's not fast, if it's not accurate, no one will use it. Not even your developers will use it. And if your developers, your own developers don't use it, you don't get the feedback that you need in the initial stage to make it good. So that's the first thing you should focus on. Elegant design and all the clever solutions that you might have, these are just refinements that you can do later. Get the basics right. Get it fast. Get it accurate. Make it multi-touch. Now why? Because if you have multi-touch implementation on your virtual keyboard, for example, it actually helps with accuracy and with speed. Now why is that so? If you look at yourself, how you might type on a tablet and you use both your hands, then you will start writing with one finger, you press one key, and you start pressing in the next key without having fully released the first key. If you think how it works on a hardware keyboard, the hardware keyboard won't lock up. It will correctly insert the characters in the order you press them. And that's the same experience you need on a virtual keyboard. If not, what the user will experience, he will not slow down by typing. He will just realize, I'm actually missing some characters here. I'm pretty sure I tapped A, B, C, and only A and C are inserted. This keyboard is crap. It's inaccurate. And when in fact, you were missing multi-touch. And that's my pet peeve, because that's often forgotten when you see all these virtual keyboard thingies and whatever. Chinese input methods. It's very, very important if you want to target Asia. And of course, Indian, Korean, Vietnamese input methods are important too. And why are they special? Because if, in Western languages, you type one letter and it goes straight to the application, and you build the word from letters and it's the right side of the application. For those composed input methods, it's not like that. For Chinese, for example, for the popular ones, you compose a symbol out of three Latin characters. So you type the first one, then you get a list of possibilities, then you type the second one, it narrows down the possibilities, So tap the third one, and then you have probably narrowed it down to two or three symbols. So it's still not context-free. It's not still not clear which character you want to have. You still need to choose. For that, it needs to be fast because the Chinese alphabet is 5,000 characters and more. And you need to quickly be able to look up all the combinations of the symbols. And based on the context, you need a really good prediction engine. And not only do you need to provide one input method for China, you actually have to provide the three popular ones. So it needs to be Zijin, Pidgin, and all what you have there. And you probably even have to provide stroke-based handwriting recognition for some areas. And then that's only China. Indian and Korean and Vietnamese languages, to a different extent, have a similar problem. They are partially composed input languages, right? So when you have your cute little keyboard and it does Western input, we haven't even started yet with your work. Because that's easy. That's the hard part. And try to find open source libraries for that. It's nearly impossible. So you probably will end up licensing that stuff from Nuance. And Nuance will charge you for each device that you put these libraries on. And then suddenly you come to a situation where you will only have the Chinese input methods on your devices that you sell to China. What happens to Chinese people that live in Europe or in America? They won't get Chinese input methods simply because of your crappy licensing deal with Nuance. If you had only used open source, oh wait, there are no good open source engines. So everyone pays, everyone goes through the same pain, and everyone starts from scratch. Very good, very efficient. Lots of money for people like me. Next thing, touch bias. Now we have all these capacitive displays, right? And where we think we aim on the display is not really where we register the touch point. So let's say we want to press a letter T. The touch point where we think we aimed is the orange dotted line just underneath the T. But where the hardware will actually register the key press is where, not where our fingernail is, but where our finger actually is. And that is quite a bit below the key. Again, that is accuracy. Your user will think, the consumer will think he has typed the letter T, and he will not register the letter key, a letter. So what can you do? Instead of making the key bigger, which won't help because then the user will just target a bit more below, what you can do is you keep the graphical appearance as it is, but you extend the reactive area where you respond to touch events. So in this case, you extend it a bit to the left, you extend it a bit to the right, but most importantly, you extend it downwards. And that's how you can correct this touch bias. If you want to make it more advanced, you could start analyzing the user profile. Is he left-handed, right-handed, posing two hands, one hand? And then this lines, actually, these two lines would have a different angle and whatever, and maybe a different distance to each other. So you can make it very advanced, and it would pay off with good accuracy, actually. The users don't need to know this magic. You do it all in a way in your virtual keyboard implementation. But it's a very interesting area to improve accuracy. And the next thing, it needs to match up with your touch display, actually. If your touch display is not fine-tuned enough in that area, then it doesn't matter that you have these pretty nice keys with these nice reactive areas. If your touch display is not accurate, if the hardware is not there, then you can't just have two fingers in the same area. They need to be apart a bit. And yeah, so if you do input methods, you should actually talk to your hardware manufacturers and request or know about the touch display limitations at least and give some feedback on what you need. That's a bit more difficult because hardware design doesn't go as fast as software design. It's not as easy, but you could do that if you have money and if you have time. Right, painting strategy. So this is maybe the most technical part of this. You can read all of this on the link that I provided there once the slides go online for you. So the painting strategy is, you would think that you start a virtual keyboard and you have 40 buttons, and you just put them in rows neatly, color them a bit differently, and then you're done. You have a virtual keyboard. Works on your desktop, doesn't work on handsets. Why? Because with 40 buttons, you have 40 buttons that process their own touch events. You have 40 buttons that paint themselves on each frame update. And you are on a constrained device. This will become slow. We can try it out. What you can actually do, which works much, much better, you have a surface, a texture, so which records the, or which just has your keyboard in its default state. And then you just draw that as a background texture, right? It doesn't matter that these keys are not active or whatever, or that these are not buttons. What you then do is you register these touch events on this global surface, and whenever a user presses somewhere, you just present an overlay. So you have this tiny area that you need to update. And you don't even need to update the background texture. That's actually the trick here. The background texture, once you have this layout up, stays the same all the time. You just have to draw these overlays. And now we think, how many fingers do we have? We have 10. How many do we use for typing? 2, 3? So that's how many overlays you will have. Maybe plus 1 or 2, because you might have a symbol key that's different, or the shift key that you need to show a different color. But that's it. So instead of drawing 40 buttons all the time, we have reduced it now to 3 or 4. That's how you get it fast. So you can actually, if you're interested in code and if you want to try it out for yourself, there are benchmarks in this blog post. You can try that out, compile it, and compare for yourself. And maybe try on your platform whether you can come up with a similar painting strategy. The ideas are always the same. I've also given the steps that you need to follow to reach it, and you can try it out. Usually it's better than the logical approach to make it a widget composed keyboard. And because of the global gesture that we have here, it's actually one detail. If you probably all know the swipe keyboard, which uses gestures to recognize words. This is much easier to do if you have a global surface where you get all the touch events. It's a bit harder if you have buttons that would steal your touch events and then you have to combine that again. So this works good for painting, and it also works good for touch event handling. Right. Now, the next thing here, you have on the left side abstract presentation, the abstract view of an application, right? We have a title here, and we have a close button, and we have text. Now we start, we want to type something, so we press on the text area. And then there are two possible solutions. The one could be the virtual keyboard comes up, and we show a proxy widget, which is what you see in the center. This proxy widget solves one immediate problem. We can very easily fix the cursor visibility problem, because we only need to scroll in that little text area there. And once you press OK, we just take that whole text and insert into the application. That's what iPhone does. Now, what's the disadvantage of that? You actually lose space. You lose a lot of vertical space. You will notice that when the virtual keyboard pops up, we already removed the decorations, the window decorations, to get some more vertical space. Because we probably don't want to play with the menus, and we probably don't want to close the application right now. We want to actually type, and that's temporary. So it's okay to hide the decorations, and once the keyboard goes back or hides again, we show the decorations again. But still, with this proxy text widget, we lose a lot of vertical space. So the alternative to that is get rid of the proxy widget and do it all live in the application, in the text editor itself. Now, you've set yourself up for a nice goal and for lots of problems. Because now cursor visibility means you probably have to change the layout of the application. Before it was a full area that was under control of the application, and now the area is much, much smaller. So you start re-layouting. Now I don't have to tell you that re-layouting is expensive, especially if you do it often. It's keyboard up type, re-layout happens, you lose 50, 100 milliseconds. So the user is going to complain because the users will start to recognize the glitch and the repainting and whatever. So if you have a complex UI, this re-layouting is actually something you want to avoid. What you can do, you can actually avoid the re-layouting and just expand the viewport and then just scroll everything up. But then you actually have to think about nested viewports and do the scrolling correctly. So that can become very difficult, but again, you can actually find that more detailed on my blog. That's actually a very nice technical document that explains all the problems you will hit with the right solution. So I would advise you go with the center solution first. And if you have time and money left, try to do the right one. But it's difficult to get it right. Text selection and formatting. Right. This is again about the user performance and the issue we have on a touch display that we have no context menu on right click, right? On the desktop, we have the left mouse button and the right mouse button, and the right mouse button pops up the context menu. That's what we probably see in the screen to the left. On a touch display, we have normal touch, and we have maybe a long tab. And often enough, this long tab will then be used to emulate a right click. So let's think about what would we do in the first screen. We start to select text, where the yellow dot is, and then go all the way down, down, down. Then the application realizes, oh, text was selected. Maybe we should show up the context menu. And then maybe it's in your way or whatever, or yeah. Maybe you wanted to insert text and then not just selecting or what. You could do that. But because you already focused the application, chances are your virtual keyboard is up. And then instead of having this context menu, which is what you would do on a desktop, which fits or works on a desktop very, very well, instead of having that, you might have a toolbar on top of the keyboard. That's what we see in the middle here. And then you have the copy, paste, close, and these formatting buttons right there. And then you just need to select, and then pressing one of these buttons will apply the formatting to the selected text. That's very easy. Users will understand it. But you will probably always show this toolbar, or it will become glitchy again, because you start showing that toolbar once text is selected, and you will hide it once the selection goes away. So this will be very, very noisy for your user. The next problem is this toolbar is a bit far away from the text selection, because we will select the text with our finger. And then we have to go all the way down to the toolbar and hit there again. So a more intelligent approach, maybe, is to detach that toolbar and make it so that it follows your finger. So it's always very close to your finger where you just selected the text. And then it just go down or go up and select the formatting or whatever. And it only appears when necessary. So it won't clutter your virtual keyboard implementation. You still, and most of the time, you will have all the vertical space. Now, the problem with the right solution is you have to think about where to position that toolbar. Because if you select at the top, then where to put that toolbar, actually? Bottom, top, left, right. So you need to think about that a bit and figure out where to place it. And then, for example, when users start penning text, what do you do? Should the toolbar follow the cursor like a rabbit? And always, that's going to be very noisy. You probably want to hide it temporarily and then show it up again at the right place. Things like that you need to consider. Only you will only find out what's right for your platform, for your form factor, if you go through UI testing and have actual users providing feedback. Because what I can tell you, on a tablet, it's much, much different than on a handset, this whole experience. Yeah. Actually, that's it. So, other questions? No questions?
Yeah, just one, actually. So, I think a major issue...
Can you use your microphone, maybe?
Yeah, I think one of the major issues with text input for like non-Western languages is that font, as I was talking to you earlier.
Yes.
So how do you think we should address that issue? Like inclusion of TrueType fonts for devices?
Yeah, that's not so easy. You see, because these TrueType fonts, if you do that for every possible language, take up quite a bit of space. So what you would do is, the same way that you configure your device initially, where you select your Google account and set up your internet connection, it should then allow you to install these TrueType fonts, and they should be freely available for download from your operating system provider. And that's probably the best way how you save space. You don't have to put it all on the device image. But you still allow your users to easily install these TrueType fonts. Actually, I don't think that the user should select TrueType fonts explicitly. You should just select the input languages that you would like to use, and then it should all happen in the background.
Okay. I hope it's as easy as you put it out to be with how the fonts get installed onto the device. Because I think currently for Android, it's a bit difficult because I think the font needs to get into the ROM and stuff. It's a little complicated, so I think we need a workaround for that, for Tizen at least.
Well, actually, on the Linux desktop, this problem is pretty much solved, right? You put it in a special folder, and you run the script that will then analyze it and register it, and then it's instantly available. No reboot needed, and it doesn't even take long to even scan 100 fonts or so. And you won't have 100 different fonts on your device.
Right.
That's the next thing, usually. So actually, it works on Linux. Why is it so hard on Android? I can't really tell you.
Yeah. It's just experience.
Yes. Any other questions? Or you're probably all tired and want to have your break now?
So what would be the first... Oh,
go ahead.
Okay.
Maybe you can... Yeah.
In terms of memory footprints and execution runtime, What are the trade-offs to make user experience much better than, like, let's say in Android. Right now in Android, I'm really frustrated because I'll be typing stuff and then it just start pausing and not able to finishing what I'm typing, and then 5 seconds later it start popping a whole bunch of stuff up.
Oh, right, right. That's actually one funny aspect. Reviewers, when they find a slow keyboard, they will say it's probably the memory footprint that is too high. There are so many other reasons, and it's most likely not the memory footprint. So what can happen is, for example, latencies that you have with the display server. So probably the latter is already in the application, just that the display hasn't updated yet. Can happen if you have latencies. The other thing is, if you have word prediction or error correction, it could be that you have a huge database or very inefficient. It could be that your user dictionary has grown so big, but there was no search index created for your user dictionary. So by deleting user dictionary, you could probably get back your performance sometimes. Just because no one has thought about, some users might actually use that feature to add words to their user dictionary and end up with a user dictionary of 1,000, 2,000 words over time. So if you have error correction or word prediction engines, so if you have these sophisticated keyboards that try to predict text, this can actually take a long time, depending on the approach they use. So for example, if they use text n-grams, then you can usually provide very quick results based on 2 or 3 grams. But for some languages, you actually need 5 or 6 n-grams, and then the lookup becomes much longer. And then if you, again, use this user dictionary problem, this needs to be processed, and it usually doesn't happen. So most of the time, I think it's actually not memory consumption. It's latency that's involved because different components need to talk, probably different processes even. And then the display update that might just skip one update, and then it looks like this 20 or 30 millisecond delay can already be noticeable sometimes. If you miss one frame update, you see the glitch. And the other thing is, how sophisticated do the keyboards actually get? What kind of, database engine, word engine is running behind? And then that causes I/O often enough, because you just can't load everything into memory, especially if you come back from that. And yeah. Well, iOS has mostly reduced the latencies between the components because it mostly runs all in one process there. I know it's doing something similar, but what iOS has optimized is mostly latencies. So, and that's why it appears fast. Not necessarily start. The best thing we could do is actually bring these people together, because you will have in Asia, the situation is so that many, many people start writing input methods. As soon as you have a device and Korean is not supported, you will find people who try to hack around it and try to write it. They will only do so once the device is there. And they will do that for every new device that appears. So one thing that you can do is bring these people together, because we all have the same problem to solve, right? Bring them together in one project. And join the efforts. The next thing would be, we already have IBUS, which IBUS table, for example, can be used for Chinese input methods. To extend that, to show this can be used on your desktop, this can be used in the application, so integrate that solution everywhere and make it more visible. Because currently, input methods on your desktop or where the hackers are, it's not very visible, because most of us living in Europe or in the US don't need it, right? So we don't think about it. We often forget it, and it's always an afterthought. And we have no clue actually how to design it properly, because we are not using input methods on our desktops, most of us here, at least. If you go to Asia, it's different. Their input methods are very common to use. And they, of course, they think about it. But open source is strong in Europe and maybe the US, and that's a problem that I see. Yeah, bring them together and don't let them start all over again for every new device or platform. There need to be libraries, there need to be an effort to collect the experience and, have it ready to go, have it good enough.
I'm not sure if you have mentioned it. What about stuff like feedback, like visible feedback, audible feedback, and tactile feedback? What do you have very nicely on hardware keyboards usually, at least the tactile feedback. What's the state of the art in terms of virtual keyboards right now, and what could be improvements in terms of hardware or software to make it?
Right, right. So if you want to get, for example, one haptic feedback that you can do is as a screen vibration. And then every screen, every touch display does it differently. Some have only one sensor, some have four in every corner, so they actually are aware where does it happen a bit. That can help a lot. But then talk about drivers, and then there's one big company providing this, Immersion, and there's no open source feedback driver for that. There are frameworks that then can use these drivers, but the driver itself that actually controls the hardware is mostly not open source, and that's one of these. It's in a similar ballpark as with a graphics driver. It's very hard to get open source graphics drivers. The companies who do that don't want to give that away, this knowledge. And the same with haptics. There's lots of know-how in that area and lots of different ways how you can do it. And yeah, that's really knowledge that's money. And they won't give it up easily. You can, at least the audio feedback, we can already do with open source solutions. But haptics as a tactile, that's difficult. Any other questions? All right, then thanks for your time and good luck with Tyson.